Rick Smith is next on the Horn.
In with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, hey, looky here, it's Tuesday. I'm Bob Kincaid, this is The Horn, the Head On Radio Network, America's liberal voice. It's a little something we call conversation radio. Unlike just about anything going on anywhere else, frankly. And we're proud of that fact. We are counting down to our 6th anniversary. That'll come on Monday. But there's a program note. We will have to mark our 6th anniversary either Friday or Wednesday. Yeah, cheating, I know. Because I won't be here Monday. Now, I'm not playing hooky, and I'm trying to give you as much advance warning as I possibly can. The Environmental Protection Agency is visiting Charleston. They're, of course, going to be meeting with the hacks and flacks of the West Virginia Department of Environmental Permitting, Protection. And we're going to have a chance to meet with them a little bit too. And they've got a little bit of pushback coming from the hillbillies. And in light of that fact, I need to be down the mountain in Charleston and a part of that meeting. So consequently, no more on Monday next week. Then on Tuesday, as promised, we have another of Dr. Bill's Prism West Virginia chat series. You want to be on hand for this one because we're going to be moving up into the 19th century, and it will be principally led by Professor Keith Lilly. And I think you'll find it very much both, yes, entertaining and informative. And isn't that really the best combination when we're talking about the learning? How much do we really learn from somebody who talks like Ben Stein? Yeah, not much. So we've got a Dr. Bill Prism West Virginia chat series on Tuesday and Monday. I'm down the mountain in Charleston to meet with folks from the Environmental Protection Agency. because they've got a little pushback coming. We've got to, and we've got to let them know that we who continue to insist upon the ability to breathe air and drink water have their backs. And that we will, and that we'll take care of the thugs here at home if they'll just do their jobs. Again, I hope you know. I hope you don't get upset with this kind of stuff. I feel a moral compunction about it. If all I do is sit here and talk about it, I am, as the book says, as sounding brass. I guess St. Paul had never heard of Herb Alpert, but because he uses that in a pejorative term. You know, it's a real clank. But I can't just talk about it. I have to be part of it, and I have to do it. So I hope you will be kind enough to be patient while we take care of those matters. But yes... Yes, the horn on officially on Monday the 24th will be 6 years old in this incarnation. The ideas behind the horn and the idea of me broadcasting actually goes back more than 8 years. 9 years in 9 years in 2012 in May. But in this effort, this listener-supported effort, it's 6 years old on Monday. And we are listener supported. I want to thank the two individuals yesterday who contributed to the Thrifty 250. You remember, we've got a sizable audience out there, and all we seek is 200, and it's much larger than any 250 people, I can tell you that. We look for 250 people per month to kick in $10 a piece. That would take care of the entirety of the horn's bills. And thus far, here on the 18th day of October 2011, we are far behind in our fundraising goals. Hopefully we will have a mad dash at the end of the month or something. But we need, on any given night, we need between 6 and 10 folks to step up in the Thrifty 250 and kick in $10 a piece. And I know how hard it is. Believe you me, I do. I sincerely do. It is a sacrifice for everyone to keep all of this going. It's a sacrifice for our chat room moderators. It's a sacrifice for our news ninjas, our blogger, all the people, John Fox, Ben Birch, all the people who voluntarily do this without getting paid. And it's a sacrifice for those who reach into their wallets to make sure that those volunteer efforts can be supported. So there you have it. That's the schedule upcoming. And I like to get that out front. By the way, the PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. There's a tab there called Contribute. You don't even have to have a PayPal account to contribute. I want to be abundantly clear about that. We can take contributions straight off of whatever plastic you use, e-checks, that kind of stuff. The only thing we really can't do is, you know, we're not in the business of marketing. Well, never mind. That wouldn't have been funny in the first place. So there you go. Now, the snail mail address is also there. 1038 North Eisenhower Drive. Carol asked for that last night when he called from Vegas. 1038 North Eisenhower Drive. PMB 318 stands for personal mailbox. Beckley, Beckley, WV 25801. I've got me, in fact, that snail mail address is useful for a number of things. I'm having my evening cup of Republic of Tea Ginger Peach Decaf. More free product placement. Yeah, Bob, that's a great way to raise funds. Give people free advertising. Not that they'll ever notice. Republic of Tea, ginger peach decaf in a vibrant blue Viagra mug. Kindly provided by Jug of Punch from the chat room, otherwise known as Thomas. It came filled with vibrant blue M&Ms. And we cleared those out and gave it a good hot water rinse, and, well, I've got my tea. So thank you. Thank you very much, Thomas. Now, as far as the evening itself is concerned, where to begin? One of the things that's most fascinating to me is the learning process that I go through in the course of pulling together a show every day. And I won't necessarily refer to these things as spiritual, but it's kind of hard to evade the somewhat spiritual, not religious, but spiritual quality that they have. Because if you recall last night's program, and I hope you do, you'll recall that we spent, the first hour's filibobster had to do with the overall concept that wherever it is that some poor folks have a little bit of something left in their world, there are always wealthy people who want it. Whether it be a centuries and generations old culture of African Americans born and bred of African slaves kidnapped and stolen here by white folks in the 18th century on the coastal islands of Georgia and South Carolina, or whether it be hillbilly culture hidden up some holler somewhere, sometimes interbred with First Peoples who refused to be genocided by Andrew Jackson. If they've got some little plot of ground, there's some wealthy son of a bitch who says, well, we need to blow that up. Or, you know what? We need to put another incarnation of my McDonald's franchise on that there island. We talked about that at considerable length last night. So imagine my surprise, or lack thereof, when one of the first things that jumped out at me today was a story from what is, for me, far-off California. And in particular, an area of northern San Diego County, a place called Gregory Canyon. It's a hell of a story. You know, one of the greatest problems that faces any human culture, any human gathering of peoples, whether they be tribal or conglomerate or metropolitan or what have you, is what we do with the day-to-day waste and the detritus of our existence. Our garbage. You might perhaps ask Horn resident archaeologist Dr. John, and he might tell you that one of the best places to find out what an ancient people whose only remains in the muddy dust are material goods, one of the best ways to find out what they were up to is to go into what are called their middens, M-I-D-D-E-N-S, wherein they piled their trash. Out there on Sapelo Island, I didn't get to see it, but it's there, is a huge shell midden, thousands and thousands and thousands of years old, from which we can learn, for instance, what sorts of seafoods, foods from the sea, not talking about using little shrimp forks or anything, this culture was eating, and what they did with the shells and things like that. But the problem we face as we have moved, and especially European peoples, you know, European culture at the time the Americas were quote-unquote discovered were very, very dirty, filthy, nasty places. You know, with people basically defecating in buckets and throwing it out into the road every morning. Yeah, I know it's the dinner hour. Sorry, Scott. Sorry, Linda. But they did that because these white Europeans weren't quite clever enough to figure out plumbing. Never mind the fact that the Romans had had it before them, and the Greeks, but the Romans, engineers that they were, sorted a lot of it out. But along came Mother Church, and much of ancient Rome's knowledge was buried under a deluge of superstition, hate, violence, and fear. Lost, in other words, leading to the Dark Ages. And even the, you know, even during the Renaissance, you just didn't want to go walking down the neighborhood side streets of Renaissance Florence or Renaissance Venice or Renaissance London or Renaissance Paris or Renaissance Madrid, because you might just very well wind up with a big bucket of wet sloppy poo and pee over your head, because that's how white Western European people are. And they carried that attitude to the New World. And not only did they carry it, they expanded upon it. And because they were so soaked in filth and ordure and nastiness, they were little biological, little two-legged biological weapons. And the minute they got near the native peoples here died. Because the white Europeans were so inestimably filthy. But still, they built their towns. The towns became cities, and the cities became vast metropolitan areas. And something had to be done with the garbage. As lovely as that city is, San Diego has a garbage problem. 20 years ago, they proposed a brand spanking new landfill. That's a fancy modern term for garbage dump. And of all the places where that landfill could have gone, and bear in mind that the places where it could have gone were narrowed because, of course, there was always some wealthy developer saying, well, certainly you can't put it here. I was planning on putting in 400 units of my McMansion complex. Right? Well, you can't put it here. I was going to put in a gleaming, shiny office tower. Hold on. Oh, don't put it over there. We were putting in a golf course, and a new hotel, and a Margaritaville bar and cafe and t-shirt shop. So the available places to put San Diego's garbage became narrower and narrower and narrower and narrower, until finally one of those people who tugs at his chest hair and has gold chains and talks through his teeth and says, my goodness gracious, look up there, Gregory Canyon, I have no plans for that whatsoever. Let's put it there. Now, bear in mind, this is a landfill that's only going to be good for 30 years of usage. Tops. And probably less than that, because they tend to underestimate or overestimate the time it will take, underestimate the time that it will take to fill the damn thing up. So guess what's in Gregory Canyon? Now, remember our topicality. Wherever there is something that is special to a group of poor people or indigenous people, or people of profound heritage, that's where we'll put the nasty thing. That's where we'll put the nuclear power plant. That's where we'll blow up the mountain. Or in the case of Gregory Canyon in northern San Diego, that's where we'll put the garbage dump. Right smack dab on top of a sacred site for the Pala Band of First Peoples. Holy crap. No, really. You got a whole bunch of dead and buried Native Americans in this site in Gregory Canyon, California, San Diego County. And we're going to bury it in diapers and beer cans and soup cans and boxes and cigarette butts. Because, you know, the old ways and the old ones, they're not nearly as important as sites sacred to Native Americans. Now, this story is bad enough, but, of course, it can always get worse. How can it get worse? Well, this is one of those instances where political representatives actually tried to do the right thing. A bill was actually pushed through the California Assembly that would have stopped this desecration, this heaping of consumer crap on top of the bones of ancient ones. It passed both houses of the California Assembly. No, we are not going to put used Pampers by their millions and empty beef eater bottles on top of ancient Pala Indians. And it went to the desk of California Governor Jerry Brown. Remember Jerry Brown? They used to call him Governor Moonbeam because he was deemed to be such a liberal. Yeah, that day's over. Because Jerry Brown vetoed the bill in an effort to give the go-ahead to this 208-acre desecration. And this isn't just any old Native American burial ground, if such a phrase even exists. This is the last resting place of Tuckwick. An important, to say the least, spiritual figure among the Pala. Its formal name is Tuckwick Pukki. Tuckwick's house. It also contains Medicine Rock, a place where spiritual rituals were performed. It also contains the aquifer and the river San Luis Rey, again sacred to peoples who were on that land thousands upon thousands upon thousands of years before filth-covered Europeans came, spreading disease, hatred, fear, superstition, and their enlightenment. Jerry Brown, in vetoing the legislation, said, I am deeply concerned about the objections raised with respect to the sacred site. This dispute pains me given the unspeakable injustices the native peoples have endured and the profound importance of their spirituality and connection to the land. There's no question that more thought needs to be given to how we resolve this inherently difficult decision and to find ways for native people and their fellow Californians to coexist in an inexorably modernizing world. Them some mighty fine words, ain't they? But the upshot is that with the stroke of a pen, Jerry Brown paved the way to dump 30 years worth of filth on Tuckwick Pookie. Kind of hard to get all spiritual feeling about 208 acres of buried Pampers, isn't it? Yeah, me too. I think about all of this in the context of the Occupy Wall Street movement. Because by virtue of the fact that Occupy Wall Street is horizontal and largely leaderless as opposed to vertical and top-down in its structure, all things and anything can matter within the objections being raised. And although it's sort of icky and not terribly sexy to think about, one of the things that we have to take into consideration as we sit here at our ringside seats for the ultimate failure of consumerism and untrammeled rampant capitalism, one of the things we have to consider is how we deal with our junk. Lest we wind up in that 500 years hence, if that far, dystopian world of idiocracy where we're buried in our own trash. We need the best minds of our generations, calling to mind Allen Ginsberg, to not be working on the next social networking site. We need the best minds of our generation working on these nuts and bolts issues of how we continue to live on a continuously overcrowding planet without running ourselves right off of it. We need those smart grids that will get wind and solar to our major cities. But we also need to be considering the back end of that process as well. You know, there's I'm sure that in any given graduating medical school class, there's always a couple of snickers for whoever it is in the graduating class that says, yep, I'm going into proctology. Because we know what he or she is going to spend the rest of his or her life seeing. But you know what? You gotta have them. Because if that doesn't work, it doesn't matter how damned beautiful or handsome or striking or charming or brilliant you are, you're gonna die. If the refuse end of any system, be it human organ or social, social sociocultural, fails, the rest of it does too. We used to have landfills here in the county where I live. Now, if I want to do like fall clean out, and if the truck was actually here to and working and everything, which it isn't, to load up and take to the landfill, it's a 70-mile round trip to another county. Because even rural hillbillies can't figure out what to do with our waste. And we damn sure need some brains applied to the back end, the unlovely, the unsexy end of our consumption cycle. And we used to know how to do a lot of that. When I was a little boy and we would come up here to this very place where I live now, there was no garbage truck. And as a consequence, garbage was dealt with very specifically. The stuff that would rot went into compost. The paper products were burned. Not that that was a good idea. And the few metal cans, yeah, they got buried. Pop bottles were returnable and reusable. Of course, that had to go. And ball or Kerr or Mason canning jars were reused until they were no longer useful. Chipped, cracked, that kind of thing. We are so past all that, aren't we? Well, we might ought to reconsider. We're reaching a time where the culture is going to have to be told how to deal with itself. I'm sorry if right-wingers think that that's unfair or un-American or not sufficiently capitalist. Well, that's going to create jobs, Bob, on them two. Building that 200-acre landfill on top of them dead engines is going to create jobs, and America needs jobs. Not at that cost. Not at that cost. If we don't figure out how to deal with the unlovely end product of our culture of consumption, our culture of consumption will consume us. This is Conversation Radio. This is Tuesday. And your thoughts are more than welcome on a wide variety of topics. That's always the case here at the Horn. That's why it's Conversation Radio. And I encourage you to get the lines filled up lickety-split. There's three of them remaining open. We're going to the phones as soon as we come back from break. Coming up, the Green News Report with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen, one of my favorite features of the week. What a wonderful job they do, Brad and Desi. Just love them. Green News Report is on the way. And then your thoughts, your comments, your conversation. Right here on America's listener-supported liberal voice. Right here on the Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
more than one half wandering Jews, free to wander wherever they choose, are traveling together in the Sangre de Cristo, on the Blood of Christ mountains in New Mexico. On the last leg of a journey they started a long time ago, the arc of a love affair, rainbows in the high desert air. Mountain passes slipping into stone, hearts and bones, hearts and bones, hearts and bones. Thinking back to the season before, looking back through the cracks in the door, two people were married, the act was outrageous, the bride was contagious, she burned like a bride. These events may have had some effect on the man with the girl by his side. The arc of a love affair, his hands rolling down her hair. Love like lightning shaking till it moans, hearts and bones, hearts and bones, hearts and bones, hearts and bones. Whoa, 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 she said, why don't we drive through the night? We'll wake up down in Mexico. Oh, I don't know nothing about no Mexico. Tell me why won't you love me for who I am, where I am? He said, 'cause that's not the way the world is, baby. This is how I love you, baby. This is how I love you, baby.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Tuesday, October 18th, 2011.
We can't compete with China to make solar panels and wind turbines.
Republicans wave the white flag to China.
I'm not going to cave to the competition.
Obama doesn't, as clean energy jobs are the fastest growing sector in the U.S.
I do believe that the issue of global warming has been politicized.
That's right, Governor Perry, by you. Texas political appointees censor climate change from a scientific environmental report. Plus, This week's record-breaking floods now arriving in Bangkok in a year of record flooding across the globe.
All of that and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comments.
There are a substantial number of scientists who have manipulated data.
Speaking of manipulating data, Governor Perry, have you checked your own report lately? This is your Green News Report. Okay, Des, we'll get to the politics in a moment, but after a spring and summer of record-breaking floods across the nation and the entire planet, it's not over yet for the year.
Oh, no, not by a long shot. Residents of Bangkok, Thailand are racing to shore up flood defenses as the worst flooding in more than 50 years inundates that nation's capital, threatening to overtop the city's extensive flood control infrastructure due to record monsoon rains. Meanwhile, in Central America, catastrophic flooding has killed at least 90 people. Central America, Asia, Indonesia, Australia, along with the U.S. and Britain, have all battled historic floods this year that have devastated crops and cost billions of dollars in damages.
And we should be clear here to reiterate this, because it is not repeated enough, but this is precisely what scientists have been predicting now for decades. As the globe warmed, more moisture in the atmosphere, more catastrophic flooding, we are seeing exactly what the scientists predict, whether guys like Governor Perry like to censor those facts or not.
And Governor Perry has an additional headache. Infrastructure in Texas is also suffering sustained expensive damage, but for the exact opposite reason as Bangkok. As Texas enters its second year of record-breaking deep drought, roads, bridges, pipes, and buildings across the state are buckling, heaving, and cracking due to the record drought drying out and compacting the soil several feet down. The record drought also caused a rare dust storm to sweep across the Texas Panhandle on Monday, where the 8,000-foot-high wall of dust enveloped Lubbock, Texas. Based on drought records, the Texas state climatologist recently predicted a 25% chance that the Texas drought could last up to 10 years.
And we've got some very cool video of that dust storm in Lubbock, Texas at our website, greennews.bradblog.com.
Meanwhile, researchers in Texas have accused the Texas State Environment Agency, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, of censoring all mentions of human-caused climate change from a major scientific report that documents accelerated sea level rise in Galveston Bay. That's according to the scientists themselves, who provided an unedited copy of the report to the Houston Chronicle showing the cuts. The members of the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality are all appointed by Governor Rick Perry.
So basically, the scientists talk about the effects of climate change in this report, and then Perry's political appointees actually cross out, remove the references to climate science from the scientific environmental report in Texas.
That's correct.
Amazing.
A spokesman for the agency did not deny the allegations, but instead said they vet all reports prior to publication.
Vet meaning censor, apparently.
House Republicans continue to search for signs of criminal wrongdoing by the Obama administration in its approval of loan guarantees for the now bankrupt solar panel maker Solyndra, and are now training their sights on Energy Secretary Stephen Chu. But House Republican Cliff Stearns of Florida, who supported the loan program during the Bush administration, goes even further, telling NPR the bankruptcy of Solyndra means the entire U.S. solar industry should just give it up to China.
We can't compete with China to make solar panels and wind turbines.
President Obama, whose American Jobs Act stalled in the Senate due to a Republican filibuster, responded in a recent press conference.
A Republican member of Congress who's engaging in oversight on this, and despite the fact that all of them in the past have been supportive of this loan guarantee program, he concluded, you know what, we can't compete against China when it comes to solar energy. Well, you know what, I don't buy that. I'm not going to cave to the competition when they are heavily subsidizing all these industries.
Meanwhile, a new study shows clean energy jobs remain the fastest growing job sector in the U.S. The solar industry doubled its hiring in just the last 2 years and now employs more Americans than coal mining. And the U.S. actually exports more U.S.-made solar technology than it imports.
And yet Republicans are now doing everything they can to kill solar technology and all of the jobs that go with it.
That is your Republican job-killing policy. For more on all of our stories today and those we didn't get to, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. A lot of good stuff there. While you're there, please consider a donation to help sponsor the Green News Report to help us keep telling the truth over your public airwaves. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
Chili Peppers and Californication. Love that song. Is that just real quick before we go to the phones? I just have to ask. Is that the ultimate proof that the erstwhile America Uber Allah's Republican Party has become more than just the party of no? But the party of no way, they're quitters. We can't compete with China. We're just American. We're plum dog beat. We can't compete with them on solar panels, so why even try? And just because we're sort of out ahead of the curve, take note of this, please. The next target in the Solyndra-driven all things green, all things renewable, are by definition a failure even before they get started, repiglic and attack machine, will be directed at Tesla Motors.
Tesla Motors has only gotten subsidies from the federal government because they're deeply controlled and connected to well-heeled multi-million-dollar Democratic donors to Barack Hussein Obama, who's a Marxist anti-colonialist Kenyan with deep-seated hatred of white people.
That's coming. Just trust me. This in from Andy. Email. Something's happened to Governor Jerry Brown. He's very erratic. It's hard to tell where he stands. The landfill bill on sacred land should have been a no-brainer. On issues involving corporate interests, he appears to have swung to the right. On a bill to rein in health insurance costs, he said it was too expensive for the state to regulate, $57 million, which was BS, contrasted with the cost to the state's citizens, roughly $18 trillion in annual fee increases. He also vetoed a card check type of legislation to make it easier for farm workers to organize. The Republican gridlock Grover Norquist machine seems to have a bearing on many of his decisions. If the bill alienates big business, he seems to align himself with business interests. He did pass a DREAM Act bill benefiting non-citizen high school seniors, which I believe you would find as progressive, but it also was backed by business interests. The governor is another pro-business, anti-worker Democrat. David in Tennessee noting that with regard to the Red Hot Chili Peppers song, Don't Californicate Oregon, that bumper sticker was everywhere in Oregon from 1980 to 1985. Loved it. So I think we're off to a pretty good start. And Lord only knows where our conversations will take us. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Why, hey, what's up, Tracy?
Long time no talk. I am alive and I am well, even though I am battling with a mean case of food poisoning. And I won't go into detail.
Well, no, but ick, do you know where you got it?
No. Well, I think it might have been some bad shrimp. I don't know. But on the good news is, you know, I joined Weight Watchers, and I have lost 10 pounds since last we spoke.
That's awesome. Are you feeling better on that end of things?
Yes. On that end of things, I'm working out pretty much like 45 minutes every other day, if not more. And I'm feeling I look better. I feel better. But this food poisoning literally knocked me on my rather large black ass. But I was like, oh, my God. But the good news is chicken soup does work. You know, I've never been one for old wives' tales about the chicken noodle soup and stuff, but I went to a local deli today, and by God, I don't feel quite up to par, but I'm functioning because I'm working right now because, you know, us poor Americans have no choice unless we are just dead. We got to get up and go to work every day.
Tote that barge, lift that bale, 15 miles on the Erie Canal.
It's like, I-O, so off to work I go. But other than that, I am good. I've missed you guys. I've gotten tweets from a couple of people like, where the hell are you? Are you dead? Are you alive? I'm alive. And of course, not paying attention to the news. Our governor, you know, I was so happy that he signed that DREAM Act signed the bill for the DREAM Act. And, you know, because I have a lot of friends that went through, you know, high school and all that and the community colleges and all that, but they're not documented. And I'm like, but they should have a right to an education. I hear people say, yes, we are broke. Yes, but we're not broke because there's no money in this state. We have California. It's one of the richest states in the nation. Unfortunately, our money is not being used the way it should be used.
Well, and thanks to things like Prop 13, it's concentrated in the hands of people who have no intention of letting go of it.
Exactly. And I think I've had this conversation before about Prop 13. When I graduated from high school in 1984, California schools, we were still considered a golden state. I mean, I cannot tell you how many of my graduating class members went on to Ivy League schools. We're talking Ivy League schools. We're talking the UCs. We're talking the Air Force Academy, Annapolis, you know, West Point. These places are not easy to get into, okay? And I went to a public school. So, and then along, you know, Prop 13 happened. I think I was still in elementary school. I might have either been in elementary school, coming out of elementary school, or going into junior high. And that's when the tide slowly started shifting. We had summer school programs that taught Spanish when I was in elementary school. We went on field trips. I mean, California schools were freaking amazing. And now, yeah, not so much. Well, that's, you know, went out throughout the whole country, but it's devastating more so here in California because we were the creme de la creme. We were the best of the best. And now it's just, yeah, not so much. And, you know, but I do have a good story about our tax dollars at work. We have you guys, I don't have anything out in your neck of the woods. We have what they call freeway service patrol.
Yeah, yeah, for broke down drivers and things like that.
Yeah.
They carry a little gas can in case you run out of gas. They can
get a flat tire. Well, Friday morning, I'm on my way to pick up my kids because, you know, I take special needs kids to and from school. Well, I'm on my way to pick them up, and I get a blowout. Now,
that's scary enough all by itself.
Fortunately, it was the rear tire, so it wasn't as bad. If it had been the front tire, I don't know if we would have been talking. Because I was hauling ass. I know I was going about 75 miles an hour.
Right.
But anywho, I pull up, you know, fortunately, I'm a very aggressive driver and a very skilled driver. I managed not to spin out or anything like that, and I managed to get over, even though people saw my tires smoking and all that and refused to let me over. I'm like, fuck it. If you're not going to let me over, I'm just going to take you out, too. And so people moved over and let me over. So anyway, I get over, and just as I was about to go, damn, I got to change this tire, because even though I'm a girl, I do know how to change my own flat tire. Just as I was about to do the whole thing, here comes the freeway service patrol guy. I mean, like, talk about white knight, you know, knight in shining armor and all that, all the stuff. I was very glad to see him. The whole service is free of charge and all this. They cannot, unfortunately, you cannot tip them.
Well, you know, that kind of service, there's, you know, the state has a vested interest. It's decent on its face and actually decent throughout. But the state has a vested interest in doing that because it protects public safety. It stops traffic snarls, that kind of thing. And the difference, I think, Tracy, is that you have the perspective to look up and say, this is a good thing. But the thing is, you would say it's a good thing whether you had a blowout or not because you use the roads, you pay attention to the highways, you are a professional driver.
That's it, hail to the air.
Yeah, and the other side of the coin is that somewhere in your state, and probably more than just somewhere, a lot of somewheres, there are repigligans and teabaggers and right-wingers who, you know, that's an unjustified use of my tax dollars. That's socialism. And you know what? They'll scream that until the moment their tire blows out, and then as long as it's them, it's a necessary service. For the rest of us, it's socialism.
Well, let me tell you. So, like I said, you cannot give them a tip. I tried. I was going to give them $20 just because I was just so happy that I didn't. Because if I hadn't gotten the tire changed, I was going to lose $140. So to give them $20, I wasn't going to care. But anyway, so on that note, they say you can't send an email with kudos. So as the young man is changing my tire, I'm on the side of the road with my, the one time that my AT&T phone did not go out on me.
Hooray.
And I'm sending an email saying, and the email says, thank you for such a wonderful service. I'm glad to see my tax dollars at work. And I also wrote that I am glad that I live in a state not ran completely by teabaggers and libertarians and repurposers.
Atta girl.
That's what I wrote in the email. I had to. Because I'm like, you know, it's like you said, it's a necessary service. Even though I do have AAA, do you know how long it takes?
Oh, you can grow a whole brand new crop of gray hair on your head waiting and worrying till AAA gets there.
Exactly. And I'm like, and I'm on top of the fact that I'm on the freeway, so it wasn't like I could be, you know, somewhere safe. And here comes this man, you know, basically saving my bacon on the side of the road where it could have been a really ugly situation, but because we have this service. And then I think to myself, what if I live somewhere where, you know, like I said, like if I lived in Texas? Oh my God, first of all, I would have killed myself by now if I lived in Texas. But, you know, what if I lived in Texas? That would just be, do you even think they might even have a program like that in Texas? Because in Texas, you know, I just have to play and all of a sudden everything is going to be okay, right?
Right, yeah. I don't know. They may have one of these things in Texas. Some Texan may call in and let us know that they do, and I'll be thrilled and surprised, Tracy. But no, I'm not betting that way.
If Texas Betty is listening, she should let us know as to whether or not they have that kind of service in the great state of Texas. But I've never been so glad to see a situation like that. So that's what, you know, I wrote the letter, the email. I doubt if I'm going to get a response or anything like that. With my luck, I'm now awesome to watch this thing to say, okay, she's one of those damn liberal hippie people.
Yeah, because that's what you are, a liberal hippie, Tracy. I mean, everybody who's ever heard a call from you knows that. Well, listen, I'm sorry you're fighting back the food poison bug, but the chicken soup helps. And trust me, having gone through 8 days with nothing but water, and I shed 15 pounds in that process.
Chicken
soup in the middle of something like that would have been the food of the gods. It would have been ambrosia. So keep feeling better and keep at it and keep in touch, will you?
One more thing before I go.
Absolutely.
Happy part of me, speaking about Occupy, Saturday afternoon and Pershing Square in L.A. at 1 o'clock, we're having an Occupy L.A. And you know my happy black ass is going to be there.
I'm so glad to hear it. Maybe Tim will be there, too.
Yeah, Tim from L.A. and all my homies from, you know, this side of the country. Come on down. Hang out with us. If you can't get there by car, you can take the red line right to Pershing Square because I'm not going to drive. I'm going to drive my car to the red line station in North Hollywood and take the red line the rest of the way. But I these are things that we need. I'm tired of these crazy white people who are feeling that they don't have to pay their fair share. I'm tired of these fools with getting these million dollar bonuses on my back. And something has to change. And if it takes me going and hanging out for a few hours in Pershing Square, along with my federal, my other comrades across the country and across the world, so be it. And that's it for that.
Absolutely. And you know what? I hope you'll report back, Tracy.
Oh, yeah, I will. Like I said, I'm just glad that I'm, you know, I'm back among the living, and I missed you guys. I missed you. And I'm glad you're back amongst the living because I every time I got ready to say, oh, I got to call or stop listening to the show, I'm either sick or traveling. So now I'm glad that you are amongst the living and everything's okay with you, too.
Well, we're working on it, if nothing else. Thanks, Tracy. Have a great night and drive safe.
Always. Talk to you later.
Bye now. Calling from the road somewhere in Southern California, that's our buddy Tracy. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Well, hey, Juanita.
How you doing?
I'm well. How about you?
Okay. Did you eat that stuff you were talking about yesterday? Did you eat that on this last trip? I couldn't.
Oh, yes, I did. Yes,
and
I did.
Did it bother you?
No, I got, well, I was fine until I ate the fast food fried chicken, and that that was a little problem.
Not that good.
Well, but it was also combined. It was also combined with an airline flight. So, and you know, flying back in. You know, when you fly into Charleston, it can always be an adventure because there's all kinds of hellacious crosswinds up on top of the mountains, and the Jaeger Airport's just a flattened off mountain. And I mean, we were skidding side to side and crosswinds and probably some wind shear. And
it was
real exciting those last 5-10 minutes of the flight.
Mm-hmm.
Felt like we were limping in limping in on a busted B-17.
one of my uncles that was in Second World War used to tell me about riding those things. the battle of the airplanes?
Dogfights?
They kind of go in from side to side.
Yeah. That's what it felt like. Yeah, just, I mean, we were probably 6 inches off the pavement of the runway in Charleston, and we went 15 feet sideways, I swear. Because I saw the pavement move.
And how big of a plane?
Oh, it was a Canadair J220. I think those things were originally designed to transport hobbits or leprechauns from one place to another because somebody who's 6 feet one sitting next to the window, you're sort of huddled up there like one of those Peruvian mummies up on the mountain with your chin on your knees. But it holds about 76 people, twin engine jet mounted at the rear of the fuselage, and really unpleasant. Now, getting in and out of Jaeger Airport's quite pleasant because there's, you know, seldom a lot of in the way of lines or anything. Get on, get off, get done. But the landings can be a little exciting.
Really? What has that?
Well, like I said, you know, getting blown around like a half-empty Cracker Jack box.
Oh, really? Oh, till then. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, you're about the same size as my son, and he has a time hunching up on
And it's not like if you've got the aisle seat, you can stick your leg out in the aisle because then, you know, then you're tripping the flight attendant and they frown on that.
Yeah. Now, just say a little aside about that service that you were talking about in California. I've never heard of that. I don't think we have it in Florida.
I don't know. I just got an email in from David
heard.
In Tennessee saying...
That would be wonderful. That would be wonderful.
Yeah, Texas has no such service. He was answering Tracy's question. He said, no such service in Texas. There is, however, a church group that would come by on Sunday after services before they all go to a cafeteria for cold roast beef and green beans.
You mean before they go to the cafeteria?
Well, you know what?
And talk about those.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. It's a very narrow.
Talk about those heathens working on Sunday?
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole point, Juanita. It's a very narrow window.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to say a little something about what Carol said yesterday, was talking about President Obama. I like to put my little 2 cents worth in. I don't know if I can make any sense out of this about how I feel about him.
Go right ahead.
I still love him, and I'm still disappointed in him. And I'm still, I'm holding my breath and hoping he'll hold out and continue like he's going now and get it even better, you know, that he realizes that he needs somebody to back him up. But I'm still holding my breath. I don't trust that he'll stay the course. Yeah, does that make any sense?
It makes an abundance of sense. And I think you have probably expressed something as well as elegantly as could be expressed, Juanita, because I still love him, and I'm still disappointed in him. Somebody that you don't care about, you don't bother to be disappointed in.
Right.
You know, we were never disappointed in George W. Bush. We were furious with him. We may have despised him, some of us, but that was because we knew what kind of incredibly poor example of a member of the human race he actually was.
Yes, he
but
was.
you don't waste chagrin or regret or remorse or disappointment on a George W. Bush. But when someone makes promises like Barack Obama made, yeah, disappointment born of true genuine decency of spirit, that's exactly it.
Yeah. And you know how it could have been. It could have been so much better. We had the control that was wasted. And I don't know how we could have done much better with the Senate. But I do believe that some of the things I still say about we could already have public auction. We could have just had, Medicare for anybody that could have, you know, couldn't get insurance if they wanted to. They pay into it like everybody does, and if they needed help paying in it, like some people do, they could get that too. But no, it just went on and 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 on. And now it's still not in full force, and if it will ever be. That's just one thing.
Right, absolutely, yes.
And it was just so much time wasted on the hearings and all about it. And then us being held in limbo, like, you know, thinking, will we get a public option or not? You know, and it still is a confusing thing. But anyway, that's not the reason I called. Well, I did want to say that, but can I say something about Martin Luther King? And
yes, indeedy.
I was thinking about they had that, what you call it, where they unveiled the statue.
Dedication.
Which I don't really, I'm not really too crazy about it, but then it's not none of my business. You know, it, you know, I think they should have had something more personal. It's too aloof to me. Am I wrong or,
Well, the thing that just crawls all over me about the Martin Luther King statue is that ultimately it was created in a means that was directly contrary to everything that Dr. King stood for.
Right.
But
he was always with people.
Yeah, but one of the things that bothers me the most, I guess, is the overall recreation of Dr. King into this sort of benign Santa Claus character. It is a
wonderful human being.
But he also didn't hesitate to say that there were changes badly needed in this country, and that's as far back as, you know, the Riverside Church Beyond Vietnam speech of 1967. If you've never read it or heard it, Juanita, you should look it up. Just look up Riverside Church speech, 1967 MLK.
Okay.
You'll find a transcript or even maybe a YouTube link. Because he was talking about stuff that never gets mentioned on Martin Luther King Day. All that benign Santa Claus stuff that they've turned him into. He was talking about a revolution in values. He was talking about how we deal with even what was then mild compared to what we have now, concentration of the of the nation's wealth in the hands of a very, very few human beings.
Yeah.
And that's what got him shot. You know, he was planning a poor people. It was being called
poor people's march.
When he was killed, and it was going to be in D.C., and he described it as being a profoundly disruptive force. And he wanted it to be a disruptive force because he wanted the power structure of the United States to understand that, yes, there is a problem. I think it was Chris Hedges in an essay entitled "A Movement Too Big to Fail," who said that, you know, it's only taken, you know, a generation for that poor people's march to begin to gel and come together, but that's what we're seeing in Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah. Well, you know, some of them are saying about Occupy Wall Street, oh, they don't have anything. They're all, this one wants that and the other one wants the other. Well, we're not good steppers, that's for sure. Like the Tea Party, they want everything the same way, I guess. But we're not like that. We're all individuals. And me, that's what the United States is.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's hard to forget what Van Jones said a couple of weeks ago. He said, the right wing talks about individualism, but they act collectively.
Oh, yeah.
He said, on the other hand, our side talks about collectivism, but we act individually. They talk individuality, act collectively, we talk collectively, and we act individually. And that reduces our effectiveness by orders of exponential magnitude.
By the way, Cenk is up there now.
Oh, at Occupy Wall Street?
Broadcast, and he's going to broadcast all week. And he was saying, he said it was wonderful. And he said, he was talking about they weren't, that park is not, doesn't have grass, it's concrete. They're actually sleeping on concrete. Well, you know, of course, a lot of them got the sleeping bags and all. But, he just said it was just totally different than what you see on TV. He went through a lot, you know, things, you know, that they're just reporting lies about or little snippets, you know.
Now, is he going to be broadcasting actually from Liberty Square, or is he going to be in a studio somewhere up there?
No, he's outside.
Good for him.
Yesterday, yeah. And I had gotten an email the other day last week. They were trying to get permission, and they didn't know if they were going to get permission to go up there. But, yeah.
Is he sending video and audio, or just audio, or what?
Well, you know, they have what they have on their show is audio and video. And what I watch the rerun. And you can get it if you have internet, you can get it on internet. That will repeat our show does. You know. And it repeats, and they put it on probably that night. You'll see the next days or something.
Right.
Like last night.
Oh, I'd get, Juanita, I would give anything to be able to do that.
I know it.
But, you know, that would take funding that we simply do, well, we just don't get.
I know. But he is telling, you know, the real lowdown on it. And he said it was just a wonderful, wonderful thing. He said he just felt so good being there. And I would recommend anybody that can get it to look. Now, they're on, I forget what time of day they're on live, so they could see it live. I think it's maybe from 3 to 6 or something like that. And, you know, Eastern time.
Right.
But anyway,
I'm curious about the logistics of it. I wonder how he's doing the electricity thing, because no battery will hold out for that length of a period of time.
Well, I don't know. You know, they've got a thing going on YouTube now. I think the YouTube of is just little sections of the shows.
Yeah.
And you could get that on their website too, but anyway, I just it's so nice. Now this morning they had on Washington Journal, they had that Goldberg guy, you know, his mother's a publisher, you know, the one that was friends with Linda Tripp.
Right, yeah.
He was on talking about it, and come to find out he hasn't even been down there. He says, I'm relying on, you know, these are friends of mine, and they've been out there several days, you know, making observations. And, of course, you know, his observations were not good. Why don't they, he said, they're so angry. Why don't they vent their anger in a good way, you know, get something accomplished? But anyway, so, and another thing about, I would just say one more thing about Jack, you know, that new girl on CNN.
Oh,
new or not.
What's her name, Barnett or something?
You should have heard him. You should have heard him talking about her, you know, when she was talking about the people there. He just really let her have it. It is so funny the way he does. But, again, there's one more thing I wanted to say, and this is sort of in reference to Martin Luther King Day, and well, it's not Martin Luther King Day.
But the dedication of the monument.
Right. And my friend that passed away, my best friend that passed away, I guess it's been about 3 years now. And she and I became friends later in life. We worked together. I don't know if you remember me telling you about her.
I do.
Yeah. Well, she was up there. She lived in Atlanta. and was involved in all of that. And what was odd, and see, now this is one reason I believe in God, is I just think he arranged for us to become friends because we found out we were born in the same year. We were born about 15 miles apart and the same, you know, in Georgia. And, of course, she was raised in Georgia and I was raised in Florida. And we probably wouldn't have been friends years ago because of all this stupid prejudice. And she was with them, and she said that Martin Luther King and his wife, she said, she went to their church, too. She said they were the sweetest, most humble people, and so kind of, they weren't puffed up or conceited or anything. And they could have been, you know. I'm a great man, you know. I'm a great woman. But I want to just say about her, God bless her. I'm so thankful that I changed and got to have her as my best friend. I still consider her that, and I really miss her so much.
Well, that's beautiful, Juanita. It is.
But because, I'm going to say that in memory of her.
Absolutely. And that's a testament to the transformative power of friendship. You know, Gertrude Stein said, friends are the family we choose for ourselves. I get more stories here about families that can't communicate, can't get along. Thanksgiving is a living hell because there's always a couple of right-wing relatives down on at the end of the table that got too far into the eggnog and have to start talking about that socialist Barack Obama.
Yeah.
When we find friends with whom we can form collegial bonds and common cause and lift each other up, that's no different to me than blood kin.
And I got into it with about when I was at the doctor's office the last time. We had to wait a little bit because they were behind, and this one woman, and she was nice, and we were talking, and all of a sudden she says something about maybe if we didn't have this president. And I said, well, what about all these guys that are running for Republican president? I said, I'd be scared to death to have any of them as a president. And I just started going on and on about all kind of stuff. And I said, these people that call themselves Christians, and they think that they're going to be going in the rapture. And I said, they're going to be fooled by the Antichrist. If there's an Antichrist, they're going to be fooled by the Antichrist because they're fooled by all these.
Well, they already are now, aren't they?
Right, right.
I was going to save it for tomorrow night for prayer meeting, but I don't know if you saw this, but our buddy, and I say that facetiously, our buddy Francis Pat Robertson.
Yeah.
Wanted to make
Marion.
Sure.
Isn't it Marion?
No, nah, it's not Marion. It's something. The I don't know.
That is his name. Is Marion?
No, it's Marion. Yeah, it's Marion something Robertson. Right. That's it. Yeah, not
whatever.
Francis. Not Francis. But he wanted to make sure that people understood that that just because we're in some difficult economic times, Juanita.
Uh-huh.
Isaac sent this along to me. Pat said it's very, very important that even though people have less money, that they continue to tithe to God through him, of course.
Of course.
Because, you know, he's God's pass-through agent.
Yeah.
Sickening nerve of that?
Yeah.
Well, even though you can't make your mortgage payments, you got to send me some money, and I'll put in a good word.
That's right. That's what they teach. And they're really into that. They talk about money all the time. Money, money, money.
Well, that's their God, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Okay, well, Bob, you take care of yourself, and whatever. I'm going to try to watch that debate tonight.
Well, I'm kind of grateful. I'm kind of grateful for the fact that I'm behind the microphone and don't have to watch that pageant. I don't know. Maybe,
well, I kind of like to know what's going on because it's funny, but it's extremely sad. It's extremely dangerous.
They are extremely dangerous, but I don't know. Maybe maybe Herb Cain will sing for us.
Yeah, you heard that.
Oh, golly.
Him singing Imagine?
No, a perversion of Imagine.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Juanita, you have yourself a wonderful night, all right?
Okay.
Good hearing from
you.
All
right, you too.
Take care now. Bye-bye. Juanita from Central Florida kind of keeps us grounded. Yeah, you've likely heard this too, but let's just take a snippet of it. Not that I hold anyone up as a religious avatar or anything, but this is, and it's from 19 years ago, and of course Andrea Mitchell says that this shows that Herb Cain was in touch with the common people. This comes from some shindig at Omaha back when he was hustling greasy pizza. How offensive could it possibly... I mean, this is just disgusting.
Imagine there's no pizza. I couldn't if I tried. Eating only tacos or Kentucky fries. Imagine only burgers. It's frightening and sad.
Ultimately, that's the real thing. It doesn't matter if he contributed to the obesification of America. Nah, it doesn't matter. It made him a lot of dough. Now, you can say you may say I have no sense of humor, but I'm not the only one. But he did use some of those millions he made hustling nasty, greasy slices of proto pie for a good cause. You can tell from the video, somewhere along the way, he bought himself a nice dentist and got them jacked up teeth in his mouth all nice and straight and pearly. Yeah. Isaac pointing out this little factoid. Cain arrived on April 1st, 1986 and told employees, "I'm Herman Cain, and this ain't no April Fool's joke. We are not dead. Our objective is to prove to Pillsbury, Godfather's Pizza, and everyone else that we will survive." Aiming to cut costs, Cain, over a 14-month period, reduced the company from 911 stores to 420. He cut his company by more than 50%. No, like I said, going right back to the phones, but you got to hear this little bit of disconnected cluelessness. Andrea Mitchell. Talking to Chris Saliza. Any second now. Please.
But we can't deny that he is entertaining, whether it's in a debate or this some tape that the Daily Beast dug up from 1991 from the Omaha Press Club event. Clearly a gridiron-type show, and this was Herman Cain, I think, parodying himself.
Yeah, so we get that. You already heard it. Parodying himself? I don't think so. Not in the least is that a parody.
He's got some chops. I mean, he can sing.
He can definitely sing, and I will say this, Andrew. I don't want to analyze too much into a guy singing an ode to pizza, but can you imagine Mitt Romney doing that? Can you imagine Mitt Romney doing that?
Well,
people like this about Herman Cain.
He's
a regular. He is a regular person.
Exactly.
He, you know, these things are minor things. And
really, a regular guy, Herb Cain, is a regular guy. Well, let's just take a look at that. The regular guy, Herb Cain, sat down with right-wing bastard John Stossel on Radio Rwanda to try to explain how he feels about women folks and their ability to deal with their own insides. I support life from conception. No people shouldn't be free to... What? Okay, well, we won't try to... No people shouldn't be free to abort... Oh, okay, there should be a comma there. No, people shouldn't be free to abort because if we don't protect the sanctity of life from conception, we will also start to play God relative to life at the end of life. And then there's Troy Davis. I'm just saying. So Stossel asks him again, really? Stossel asks him whether a rape victim should have the right to get an abortion. That's her choice. That's not government choice. I support life from conception, so abortion should be legal. No, abortion should not be legal. Reboot. So he asked him, third pass, if it's her choice, then it means it's legal. Herb Cain said, no, I don't believe a woman should have an abortion. Does that help to clear it up? Stossel, even if she's raped? Even if she's raped or she's the victim of incest, because there are other options. We must protect the sanctity of life, and I've always believed that. Real clear. That's the regular guy. That Andrea Mitchell says, that's the regular guy. Regular guy. You know, David in Tennessee noting that Andrea Mitchell is a total shill and a deceiver of all but her effing bridge and Pilates club. He said the video shows that huckster as a pitchman for a company making a lousy pizza that attracts investors and franchisees by pulling them in with that shtick. That duplicitous snake oil drummer has no more connection to the people than did Elmer Gantry. And that's the truth. Sorry, News Ninja Susan, sorry. Bob, you're just plain mean making us listen to that. Look, all we got in common is our misery, and the least I can do is share it, all right? So enough of me. Let's go back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello?
William up in... Oh.
Oh, hey, William. What's up?
Oh, I was just listening to Cain. You know, he gets his supplies, though. He gets Jesus of Nazareth. He gets stuff from, yeah. That guy's a...
Oh yeah, I almost left that one out. That's another one that should have waited till prayer meeting Wednesday. But yeah, a liberal Romans condemned Jesus to death.
Yeah, sure they did. Yeah, but if you had told me, if this guy got nominated, and you had told me when I was in high school there'd be two African Americans running for president, I said, "Here, pass the sign." I said, "You're crazy." That would never happen here, you know, when we were kids, you know. You couldn't imagine that.
No.
Which is the way how bad this country was. Although that kind of helped me in a way. I used to listen to WLAC out of Tennessee. I believe it was Nashville, maybe Memphis. And there's two stations, two sponsors that broadcast 6 hours of blues every night. And it was all mail order stuff because you couldn't buy this stuff in small towns in the South. So you bought it mail order for 4.45s for $5. And it was great music, you know. So, that's how segregated this country was, you know. People don't, a lot of kids don't get it. They don't understand how things were. I read Halberstam's book, The 50s, and he has a great chapter on the Montgomery boycott, which, you know, I mean, I knew about it when I was young, but man, he gets into it and you really get the story, you know.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
You were down the Sea Islands, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Sing Out did an article about them about 30 years ago. It was quite interesting. And closest I got was a week at Hilton Head with my first wife, which was a great place to, you know, vacation.
No, I was there a couple of times in the long, long ago, and there's no doubt it's a beautiful, beautiful place.
Yeah, I got terrible sunburn, but being a good husband, I performed my husbandly duty, and it was killing me. But, you know, what are you going to do on vacation, you know, when you 8 years old or something, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah, well, okay. Watch the detail, William.
Well, yeah, I don't go into too much detail about that stuff. But I got one story. This is for Mark. I'm sure he's heard this story because most Marines know the Chosin Reservoir story real well.
Yeah, and, from the Korean War, right.
Yeah. I mean, that's like Marine Corps lore. That's legend because it was. They fought their way backwards through a surrounding Chinese force that MacArthur's intelligence people didn't listen to the guys in Korea who told them there was the Chinese up there by the ton. But anyway, this guy Ned Almond was given command of 10th Corps, which included the Marines and two Army divisions. And he went in with a helicopter and he's talking to the Marines and he talked to the 7th Division the same way. Get this, Bob. He told these guys to head for the Yalu River and don't let a few, quote, Chinese laundrymen stop you.
Oh, Jeebus.
Can you believe that? And this guy, well, Almond had a record in Italy where he commanded a black outfit, and he did terribly. He was fired from command of this division. Of course, he fell back on his roots. He's a Texan. And he blamed it on the guys that were fighting under him. Italy was terrible. I mean, it was one mountain after another.
Oh, yeah, and the Monte Cassino. And
yep.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Hell, the Germans were still holding on to northern Italy when the war ended. I mean, it was just that was a Churchill.
Well, that's where Mussolini fled, ultimately, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
Wasn't he strung up by his heels, he and his mistress, outside of a gas station in Milan?
Yep. Yep, exactly. And you know, another thing, you know, when I start thinking about this 1% today, it takes me back in that historic freak mind of mine to the Liberty League. Are you familiar with those guys?
Yes.
Yeah, they're the ones that tried to get Smedley Butler to start veterans groups. You know, the kind they had in Italy and Germany.
Yeah, who wanted a coup, didn't they?
Yeah, they wanted that. Oh, no, Bob, come on. They wanted to assist President Roosevelt. That's what they told Butler.
Yeah.
And Butler went up in front of Congress and blew the whistle on him. And you know who one of those people was?
Oh, the Bush family, Prescott Bush.
Yes, sir. It's you can backtrack these guys. Prescott had to be told to stop doing business with the Germans during World War II.
Yeah, well, no, he was busted under the Trading with the Enemies Act in 1943, and that is why young George H.W. Bush became the youngest naval aviator at the time in naval history, because they trotted him out as a means of restoring the PR rep of the Bush family.
Family, yeah.
And he was a terrible pilot. Remember,
well, he got shot down, I know that.
Well, yeah, he did get shot down, and that's where he earned the nickname Bailout Bush. Because he bailed out of his burning plane and left the other three or four, I think it was a four-man crew inside the TBF Avenger, left the his other three crewmen to just go down and die.
Yeah.
And remember, now that was over Chichijima.
Yeah.
And bailout Bush was never allowed to carry a torpedo. That was the TBF Avenger was a torpedo plane.
Yes, it was, yeah.
And he was never allowed to carry actually, you know, he was kind of like Barney Fife. He had to keep his bullet in his pocket. They only sent him out on recon missions. The most dangerous thing he was allowed to carry was a camera. He went out and took pictures with his airplane and got three people killed stone dead.
Well, they say he was lucky because the commander, the Japanese commander of that island, when he captured somebody, he was, I don't know if he had onions with it, but he was supposed to be having liver. And, Jesus, you know.
But that's the way that filthy family is, William. Remember, of course, that Prescott Bush was involved in the First World War. And he wrote,
and he wrote
this smart-ass letter home to his mama talking about how he had recently in a daring act of single-handed heroism, saved both Marshal Foch and General Blackjack Pershing from certain death.
Oh, how'd you do that?
He mailed it home to Columbus, Ohio. That's where the Bushes were originally from.
Really? From my state?
And Mrs. Bush, who would be, I guess, H.W.'s grandmother.
Yeah.
Brooded brooded it all over town and had it published in the local Columbus paper, and then it turned out to be a giant lie, a complete fabrication, and the Bush family, in order to avoid being completely socially ostracized because of Prescott's propensity for being a filthy little liar, had to leave Columbus, and that's how they wound up moving to New England.
Ah, see,
remember Prescott? Prescott was a senator from Connecticut.
Yep. That whole area of people that China lobby after World War II. What is there something wrong? One of the guys Jenner called George Marshall accused him of treason. And that's when the whole House of Cards started falling in on McCarthy and those people. Because Army McCarthy hearings were just stone crazy. I mean, the guy was nuts. There were so many of them.
Something nasty, you know, just double-dealing, down and dirty, backstabbing, back alley, cut purse, foot pad nasty has happened in this country, there has been a Bush or an ally of a Bush involved. You mentioned China coming forward into 1975, remember?
His brother,
George H.W. Bush becomes the first ambassador to China, and then his brother becomes the founder, Prescott II, I think, Junior, whatever, becomes the founder of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and that's where that whole ball begins to roll downhill that winds up with hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of American workers out of work.
Yep.
Because of the expansion of trade practices and policies with the People's Republic of China.
Yeah, and that goes through from Reagan, and it goes through Walker, and it goes through Clinton, and then goes through George W. That whole ending of trade tariffs. I was in the TV
Under Clinton's administration that the ultimate granting of most favored nation trading status was extended to China. But, you know, Bill Clinton was one of those globalist guys, and he still is.
Well, the history buff in me goes back to the old phrase from the early 1900s about China, the open door policy. Well, we can all go in there and rip these people off. And the opium wars, when the English were shoving opium into China in the 1870s, 80s. Yeah, it keeps going back. If you track back on this greed, I've learned a lot from the history. I'm weakest in the revolution and in the constitutional days because the inside info there is deep.
Yeah, and that's why you enjoy the Prism series so very much.
Man, you can't learn enough, you know. I don't care, Bob, I'm pushing 70, but I'll never, if I ever stop learning this when the dirt hits me, you know? And I'll tell you another thing that people, younger people, when we get to a point where they're in the senior citizen building, and they start treating you like you're a child, and you talk about a guy that goes through the roof with these people, it's me. Don't try this stuff, you know. It doesn't work with me. I worry because the whole bureaucracy may fall apart for people that are 10 years younger than me. Now, there might be nothing when they get to my age because of this this craziness of we're spending money overseas like fools.
Well, that statistic that I found, and I found it so very shocking last night, William, that according to the present census data, the current census data, one in five recent college graduates has a tremendous likelihood, that's 20%, of winding up living in poverty.
Yeah, that was amazing. Well, what is it now, 24% unemployment against people with college degrees?
The statistics no one wants to talk about? Right.
Yeah.
When you break out unemployment in the African-American community, unemployment in the Latino community, it becomes absolutely terrifying.
Well, us hunkies who grew up in the housing projects, a lot of us didn't do that well either. Although, music was a gift. Music was a gift my father gave me, and my brother, his brother was a great electronic tech, and it got me into the TV business. And that's when I started Japanese. According to the trade publications in my business, the Japanese were dumping TVs here below cost, and their government was subsidizing the losses. And if you tried that in this country, you know, people would be screaming about subsidizing. And we do it in other ways. But at least that kept the Japanese people assembling televisions at that point in time. In the early 70s.
Right. It was more important for the Japanese government to have Japanese people working than it was for the American government to have American people working.
You know, and I go back with these right-wingers and I tell them, look, Hamilton put in a lot of those tariffs, and I wouldn't have called Mr. Hamilton a liberal, would you, or a leftist? I mean, come on, you know. And if Barack Obama's a socialist, just call me Mao. It's ridiculous. They've reached a point of stupidity that I can't stand. I don't watch these. These are debates. I don't know. This stuff got started. I still remember the Kennedy-Nixon thing.
Yeah. If you listen to it on radio, Nixon won. But if you watched it on TV, Kennedy won because Nixon was sweating like a
sweating like
church.
A pig. Yeah. Unbelievably so.
And by the way, David in Tennessee just dropped a note along. He knows of which you speak, William. He says WLAC. That's Randy Wood that took over WLAC in Gallatin, Tennessee. Randy's record store. We ship anywhere.
Randy's and Ernie's and the DJs were like Hossman Allen and John R. And man, I'm telling you, it came in on the skip. I could pick it up in Cleveland on the skip back in '56. I'm dialing around one time, and along comes Ray Charles doing Lonely Avenue, and I said, wow, what the hell is that stuff? Man, I got to hear more of that.
And David says, in the late 40s, AM 1510, equal in power to Clear Channel WSM AM 650, the air castle of the South, they had tremendous impact. 50,000 watts of power sending so-called race records music all over the nation. And David says, to the nation's betterment, says I.
Yes, sir, and that's what lit the fire under Elvis and Carl Perkins and a lot of folks, young fellas down there, were listening to that stuff and ended up, you know, playing differently. The first thing I ever bought was a specialty label thing by a guy named Little Richard. That was, and I don't know if you've seen Richard's biography, but if you ever catch the original lyrics to Tutti Frutti, you'd die laughing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And, of course, you know, whether you're talking about Carl Perkins or Johnny Cash or Elvis, you know, that all starts that all starts in Sam Phillips' Sun recording studio, or as I refer to him, my old boss, Sam Phillips.
You work for him?
I worked for Sam for a little bit.
What kind of guy was he, Bob?
He was a hard-nosed, sharp businessman. But my God, he was so far ahead of the curve, it wasn't even funny. I only met him a few times, but I got his autograph every 2 weeks.
Yeah, he was
I worked for a radio station that he owned there in the Shoals in Alabama.
Oh.
And that's one of those little T intersections on the road of life where you go one way and if you went the other, it could, you know, the whole Robert Frost two roads diverged in a yellow wood, yada yada yada. I had an opportunity. He told me one evening, he said, son, he said, don't go back to college. Stay here. Keep jocking for me. I'll have you jocking in Memphis inside of a year, and we'll make you a star.
Well, you could have done it.
And dumbass me went back to college.
Because DJs were so important. I remember Bill Randall here in Cleveland and listening to him. And one night when I was playing this one bar in University Circle area, he comes in with his daughter. And I heard him say in a loud voice to his daughter, he plays like Paul Butterfield, and I almost fell off. I almost fainted. I was so delighted with hearing him say it because, the man knew what he was, he knew music, you know, and he recorded anybody from John Lewis to New Orleans George Lewis, you know, he was that kind of a guy. But Phillips, Rocket 88, that one of the first rock records, the earliest R&B things, it sold well to everybody, you know. Well, I won't keep you because there's a lot of people waiting, and I'm not full of politics tonight, but I'm fed up with politics. I think I just hope these people can hold on in New York and everywhere else. And I think back to the cops that I used to know in the 60s that came into the one bar that I worked at because it was close to the 5th District in Cleveland. And these guys were all Vietnam vets, and these were, compared with some of the stuff I've run across today, these guys didn't have a point to prove. They had been in open combat in Vietnam where the opponents also had firearms and knew how to use them, and they came back with a different attitude as far as cops. They were there. You know, one of my buddies said, yeah, some of the times he says you see servant protect on the side of a car, and you think maybe it should be perhaps an arrest instead, and that bothers me because that's not what, you know, what we were taught about people. But anyway, I'll let you go, sir, and enjoy yourself and keep going, man, and I hope you can keep the night going as well as it has been. Take care now.
Thanks, William. Take care. Good
Bye-bye.
To hear from you, brother. Bye now.
Thank you.
That's William calling from up Cleveland way, and I tell you what, the old disc jockey still resides in me, and that's one of those moments you think about, and you wonder how it would have turned out, or maybe it was a 30-year loop to come back to here, but it was I don't know, maybe it's more important looking back on it than it was in reality. All I knew is that my parents were sweating to get me through college, and if I didn't finish college, that I'd break their hearts. Comme ci, comme ça, huh? But there is an old DJ in me, and William mentioning Carl Perkins and Sam Phillips and Sun Records and everything got me to thinking about a little something that comes from what we lovingly refer to as the Horns Patron Saint Band. We'll take a little musical interlude and come back to a very busy bank of phone lines. But, yeah, just a little interlude. The Drive-By Truckers, Carl Perkins Cabin.
Cash and he was took those pills, and he's still too proud to die. Mr. Phillips never said anything behind nobody's back. Like, damn it, Elvis, don't he know?
We got your soap right here.
And got your bad body stuff.
www.bubblegenius.com.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Yeah, the old DJ just started the music right over top of his own voice. I didn't fade up. Sometimes we get rusty. But anyway, that was the Drive-By Truckers and Carl Perkins Cadillac. And just because I don't do it often enough, a gentle reminder. Friendly reminder. Bubble Genius soap is actually vegan-friendly, non-corporate, and good for your hide. It's also a hell of a lot of fun with a lot of shapes and themes and so forth. Like the periodic table of the elements. That's a blast. If you've never checked them out, you should. Because, A, you will be cleaning your hide with something that isn't pumping corporate cash into filthy right-wing smear machines. You'll be indirectly supporting the horn. And if you enter the word horny, H-O-R-N-I-E, in the promo code box when you order online from bubblegenius.com, why, by Jove, you'll get your very own bar of horn soap for free and 10% off your order. Now, somebody kindly explain to me why you would get your soap anywhere else. Yeah, bubblegenius.com. Paula and Sarah are two of the most wonderful, fun-loving, pleasant people to be around, and what a joy it's been getting to know them ever since our sojourn to Netroots Nation in Las Vegas. If we go to Netroots Nation next year in Rhode Island, I plan for our booth to be right next to theirs again. They are a delight. BubbleGenius.com. And back we go to the phones at 2 minutes past the hour. Nope. No patience, you people. No patience. Hey, welcome to the program.
Let's get the line out to Yoko on that Imagine cover. And I bet you she has something to say about that.
I reckon maybe, you know what, maybe she would. It would be kind of cool if she'd sue Herb. Although the statute of limitations probably has run, but since it's been resurrected and it's being played all over again now.
It would be interesting to see what happens with that. It segues into a little review of the, I watched the whole George Harrison Living in the Material World documentary. Amazing stuff. I can't recommend it enough. Goes through the timeline through his early age in the beginning. Talks about the Beatles in Berlin. And goes a little bit into about what a lot of people may not know about how the Beatles, when they were starting in Berlin, how they had a couple named the Vormans. Basically back them up where it includes finances. And if they didn't get these this financial help and a place to stay at the time, there would be no Beatles, which is it's an amazing little antidote when you watch the film. And it also talks about how Vorman influenced Harrison in a lot of ways. And it talks about, you know, the relationships that that Harrison had with different cultures, including the Indian, the English culture, his love with music and meditation. And I'll tell you something, the way Martin Scorsese puts it all together, it's amazing. I mean, you got Eric Idle in it, you got Eric Clapton, you got everybody you wanted, and it's just an amazing story to,
I'd love to see it. I really, really would.
Just to see the contradictions. I mean, the way they open it up is pretty cool, itself too. They talk about how Harrison was such a stickler for taxes, and he talks about even at his dying day, he was trying to stick it to the government because he bought this mansion in Switzerland, and he knew he was dying. But he said, but Terry Gilliam was saying that, but that was just Harrison's way of saying just what he said in the Taxman song. You're not going to get me.
Right. And remember, there would be, and it is more than merely just brilliant satire and comedy and Monty Python. There would be no Life of Brian without George Harrison.
Oh, yeah, they talk a bit about that. They talk about how George Harrison just casually said, how much do you need? And Eric Idle said, oh, you know, what we need is we need $4 million, but I know you can't do that. And he said, don't worry, there'll be a check. It's like,
yeah,
wow.
I'm a freak. I'm a freaking Beatle. Yes, I can do that.
Yeah. the funny thing is like they were talking about one of the things they were talking about was George Martin and how Harrison's humor, really cheeky humor, stuck with George Martin. And they were in the studio control room, and he said, be sure, guys, if there's something you don't like, just be sure to tell me. And Harrison looks at George Martin, and he says, well, I don't like your tie for starts.
He was always said to be, what, the quiet Beatle? You know, Paul was the cute Beatle. John was the perceived intellectual Beatle. George was the quiet Beatle. And I guess Ringo was, what, the silly Beatle?
Yeah, it's amazing. They talk a bit about the dynamic between the Beatles, and I think Paul McCartney sums it up. He says, I don't like it when someone singles someone out. He goes, because what they didn't understand was the fact that the Beatles represented, the way we represented and influenced and inspired each other is what made us. And without one of the corners, there would be no group, which I thought was really a good metaphor to look at, because
there's truth to that too, David, because if you consider for instance the way that the solo careers went, there's Paul McCartney writing a top 40 hit in what, the mid 70s, early to mid 70s, that he based upon a smart ass comment from John Lennon. Paul, he sits around writing silly love songs.
Right.
And so, boom, Paul sits down and writes silly love songs, and he's still, there's a manifestation of the fact that he is still, even at sort of tangential, indirect angles, he's still writing off of the collaborative energy that was formed there.
I think one of the most interesting things about it, and I think a lot of people don't understand, that the writing and the way the Beatles wrote would not come out the way it did without George Harrison. So in a way, they were indirect muses. And a lot of people don't understand that. They don't get that. The fact that they were intangible writers, Ringo Starr and George Harrison, because they wouldn't have written what they wrote without those two guys around.
And I guess you saw that Sir Paul got married again recently.
Yeah, I heard about it. Did you see
the McCartney? Okay, this is tonight's catty moment on the horn.
Yeah.
Did you see the dye job Sir Paul had?
No.
I mean, come on, Paul, you're 69 years old. That shade of reddish brown is out of a bottle, buddy. I mean, don't sweat it. It ain't no big deal. You know, it doesn't matter what color it turns as long as it don't turn loose, right?
I think part of the problem is when this goes back to when you're in the spotlight. And I mean, it happened with Harrison, too. You can go back to, like, the 1989, you can see the Aquanet hair that Harrison has. I mean, they had to keep up with the image the best way that they could. And that's a sad thing. They go a little bit into that, of how much Harrison hated the fact that he was such a public figure in that respect. And they talk a little bit about the incident of the stabbing before his death. That's an amazing story in itself, Bob. I mean, the whole documentary, like I said, I'll send it to you. You can watch it at your leisure whenever.
Oh, I absolutely will. And your brother in the fraternity of David here on the horn.
Yeah.
David in Tennessee, noting a guy that I worked with in Oregon sent me a note stressing how imperative it was that I see the Scorsese film. He says that loop is 25 years old. So when you've got people who are 25 years in friendship, and the other one sends an urgent email to the other saying, see the Scorsese film, really.
Without a doubt, the editing on it is past superb. The comments, he even has Phil Spector in this movie, which is amazing to just hear Phil Spector, as crazy as a kook as he is, talk about the relationship when they were making all things.
Yeah, but he wasn't always a loon, you know. I mean, the whole wall of sound concept.
We can debate that. I mean, you see, the thing that people don't know about Phil Spector was the fact that the first song he ever wrote, and this shows so much. Paging Rick Goodner. The first song he ever wrote, Bob, was "To Know Him Is to Love Him," which is about the death of his father.
I had no idea.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people don't understand the fact that the reason why someone you get so insulated and so isolated from the rest of the world, and you have a loss that deep in you, and you pile yourself into work, not making excuses for what Phil Spector did, but what I'm saying is these are all factors adding up to the figure that you see today.
Well, yeah, we're all the sum of our parts.
Right, we're all the sum of our parts, and the dysfunction and the turmoil that was faced, you can hear it in you can hear it in the music that he produces, and the fact that he was so meticulous with his productions, whether it's guiding Harrison or so forth. I mean, there's definitely, as sad as it is, it takes troubled individuals to make such beautiful art, which brings us to a whole other discussion that...
I knew there was a transition in here somewhere, David.
Yeah, it's sad, but, you know, the beautiful art that we love so much, everything that we love, it all comes with a terrible price that we find out later as we grow along with age. And I guess that's the case with that's what made Harrison's music so great. And they talk about, you know, in the documentary, they talk about the fact that Harrison was really, really, really insecure about his songwriting, to the point when he was, well, who wouldn't be? First of all, the fact that they just leaped out there, Paul McCartney and you know, Leonard, oh, we got the song right here. You know,
let's write a swimming pool.
Yeah, I mean,
I want to write a Rolls Royce.
But I mean, I don't think.
I'm sorry, I keep doing my bad Beatle accent. It's just that it's. I'm sorry, I apologize.
See, the amazing thing about that time is what a lot of people don't know is the same thing. It happened with the Rolling Stones. I'm not comparing it to. We're not getting into that war, ladies and gentlemen.
But and it's one you really need to stay out of, because it's the thing that, you know, people, I'll get hate mail no matter which way you land. So, yeah, stay the hell out of that minefield.
And, you know, the whole thing with the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, this is what people don't understand. The Beatles, when they started out, they were content with being a cover band, ladies and gentlemen. They were content with that. The same thing with the Rolling Stones. They had no idea. That's the most mind-blowing thing. They had no idea. They were like, oh, we could be songwriters, yes. That's the thing about it is that they
yeah, but Jesus Christ, when you're Keith Richards, you know, I mentioned Robert Frost a few minutes ago. There's another poem Robert Frost wrote, the title of which is more important than the body of the whole long poem. But the title is it's hard to avoid being king when it's in you and it's in the situation. And you know what? I don't care if the Stones started out saying, you know, we're going to play cover tunes and we're going to play American blues for a British audience.
Right, right.
When Keith Richards, no, it was in Keith. It was in Mick. It was in Brian Jones. It was in Charlie Watts. It was in Lennon, it was in McCartney. They could say that's what they wanted to be till hell froze over, but they were going to be what they were, and they got a couple of breaks along the way. And the breaks, you know, the dumb luck stuff is always important. But by the same token, you know, that dumb luck happens more. Edison. I'm a great believer in luck. I find the harder I work, the more I have of it. Those guys had a work ethic.
Right, right. And the thing about it is, I think this is the reason why a lot of bands are just go up in flames too soon, or they never reach their potential, is if you think about the fact that in that culture, in those days, in the industry, in the rock and pop world, it was acceptable to make a record and say, you know what, I only got two songs. You only got two songs. Well, that's enough for us. Let's just do all covers, baby. I mean, you can do that in blues. You can do that in jazz to an extent. But when it comes in the rock world, that's like, that's become taboo now.
No, well, and there's an element of so, you know, modern music. I guess it just, my geezer gene has kicked in, and
I don't
freaking get it, you know. But that's not, I'm not going to stand here and be some sort of dogmatic ass and say, well, it's not good because I don't get it. No, I just don't get it. But while we're sitting here talking about important musical personages, let's throw huge kudos to Tom Morello.
Oh, without a doubt.
I mean, the man is at Occupy Wall Street. He's talking about Occupy Wall Street. He's saying it straight. He's walking his walk. Yeah, granted, he's sold a few million records.
Yeah.
And he's not going to eat beans tomorrow, but he's got a real sense of camaraderie with the people who do.
And while we're at that, let's give great thanks and props to Lupe Fiasco, who's making runs and contributing his own money to the Occupy movement in California.
Oh, cool. I didn't know.
And so, I mean, when I say when he's putting money on the table, I mean, he's putting serious money out there to get those protesters the supplies they need. And I think that's great to see. I wish we'd see more musicians on board. I kind of see why they're a little bit timid about it in a lot of respects. I know Bruce Springsteen probably is thinking, should I? He's probably thinking that right now.
Hasn't he already done some stuff? I thought I saw where he had. Maybe I was mistaken.
I mean something where he goes out there with, like, you know, with his band and on stage. I think they're probably contemplating that in the inner circles. A lot of musicians are probably contemplating that. But the problem is that we live in such an immersed media culture. Immediately, when such a big star comes up, they're going to go, oh, my God, look what it's turning into. I knew this was going to happen.
And that's that whole co-opt discussion that we had that we had the other day. And it reminds me that I do need to recommend both to you and to the rest of the Horn family that you take time to look up and read over at Truth Dig, if you haven't already, Chris Hedges' piece, A Movement Too Big to Fail.
Yeah, he's
calling out some folks who need calling out. There's a line here. Where is it? Dadgummit, just a second. I can't find it right now, but it's, you know, he's been talking for a long time now about what he refers to as the liberal class, and there's a lot of resonance to what he has to offer. And he says, the faux liberal reformers whose abject failure to I'll back up. This is how it opens. There's no danger that the protesters who have occupied squares, parks, and plazas across the nation in defiance of the corporate state will be co-opted by the Democratic Party or groups like Move On. The faux liberal reformers whose abject failure to stand up for the rights of the poor and the working class have signed on to this movement because they fear becoming irrelevant. Union leaders who pull down salaries five times that of the rank and file as they bargain away rights and benefits know the foundations are shaking. So do Democratic politicians from Barack Obama to Nancy Pelosi. So do the array of liberal groups and institutions, including the press, that have worked to funnel discontented voters back into the swamp of electoral politics and mock those who called for profound structural reform. That's big medicine.
Yeah.
Calling out Move On, calling out the Democratic Party. You know, they need called out, David.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think we're in such a volatile time now where concerns a political shift that's happening. There needs to be that support base there, and we've shown ourselves in that regard together as a union, as a progressives, and now you know, the political force and the political will has to come, and if it doesn't, I'm not going to feel sorry for him, Bob, because if it doesn't, they know pretty much what's going to happen. Which brings me to an interesting conclusion before I sign off tonight. There is a bit of a symbiosis with the Republicans and Democrats. And you have to wonder how much the Democrats don't want the Republicans to, quote-unquote, fade into oblivion.
Well, isn't that the whole dichotomy from the first Batman movie? between Batman and Jack Nicholson's Joker. You created me, I created you!
Yeah. There's definitely something to that. And I mean, you have to wonder if that's the case, okay, how far are the Democrats willing to take it to make the Republicans an irrelevant force in this country for some time? And I guess we're about to...
Well, I guess the pageant from the padded cells is underway right now. Or is it 9 o'clock or what? When they start babbling, I guess it'll be closer to nine when they start babbling away in Nevada, won't it be?
Well, you know, just to close off on this, I think we can refer to Las Vegas as the city with too many creeps tonight.
Yeah, by a factor of what, 7, 8, 9?
Yes, more than that. You got to count the audience too.
Well, ain't that the truth?
I mean, the fact that everybody knows that this, everybody knows not to break into a Leonard Cohen song. But
yeah, I wonder who the Repiglicans will boo tonight. Maybe they'll. Hey, you know what, Sergeant Shamar Thomas. What do you want to bet there's a question about him in the pageant tonight so that all the Repiglicans can boo the Marine, the decorated Marine?
that'll probably happen. And I don't know. It's, like I said, it's going to be an interesting times we live in to see what unfolds and what happens. And like I said, hopefully the Democrats will position up with the working class, because if they don't, I don't have any sympathy at this point. They know, they pretty much know at this point that, yeah, we have your backs if you support us. If you don't.
Well, how many times can they do the Lucy with the football thing to us?
I don't know, but you know, the interesting thing is that there's an article tonight on the fact that the Wall Street lobbyists are hitting pretty hard on the phone lines in the past 2 or 3 weeks. And you can imagine how bad they're hitting the phone lines, basically embarrassing the Democrats that answer the phones. Like, how could you do this to us? Like, getting personal. Like, why would you say things like that? Really, really getting psychologically into their head like that. And that's the other point that we need to understand, is the fact that when it comes time to put up support for the Democrats. If they are in complete support, and they decide to sever ties from Wall Street even more so, that's where the real rumble begins.
It may very well. And by the way, since we're talking cartoon panels, real quick, I got one more thing to share with you and everybody else. I don't know if you are, and I don't know how many others are fans of the absolutely beyond brilliant work of Bill Watterson and Calvin and Hobbes, which is badly missed.
Yeah. One of the greats.
Oh, it's got to be up there, 1, 2, 3, with Bloom County, Doonesbury, Calvin and Hobbes, everything else. But Calvin and Hobbes is special because it's sweet. It's gentle. It's loving. It's kind. And yet it's at the same time just, it was biting as hell. And for folks who want to see it, if you go over to Sly Oyster, just like it sounds, slyoyster.hypervocal, hypervocal.com, you can find a Calvin and Hobbes Sunday panel that they say, decades-old Calvin and Hobbes strip succinctly explains Occupy Wall Street movement. And it's Calvin at his lemonade stand being approached by customer Susie. You know, that Calvin and Susie had that antagonistic relationship that just let you know that when they grew up, they would be married.
Right.
She walks up to his lemonade stand, and it's lemonade $15 a glass. $15 a glass? That's right. Want some? How do you justify charging $15? Supply and demand. Where's the demand? I don't see any demand. There's lots of demand. Yeah? Sure. As the sole stockholder in this enterprise, I demand monstrous profit on my investment. And as president and CEO of the company, I demand an exorbitant annual salary. And as my own employee, I demand a high hourly wage and all sorts of company benefits. And then there's overhead and actual production costs. But it looks like you just threw a lemon in some sludge water. Well, I have to cut expenses somewhere if I want to stay competitive. What if I got sick from that? Caveat emptor is the motto we stand by. I'd have to charge more if we followed health and environmental regulations. You're out of your mind. I'm going home to drink something else. Oh, sure. Put me out of a job. It's this anti-business type who ruined the economy. And you see him walk in and look at his mother. I need to be subsidized.
You know, that is the epitome of Godfather's lemonade right there.
Isn't it? I mean, you've eaten Godfather's pizza, right?
No, actually, no, I haven't. I don't go for that stuff, so.
Well, blessed you are.
But one other thing I wanted to bring up before we close for the evening with my conversation is that, you know, the fact is that we're having such problems with market shares right now. This hits it home for me, and this will hit it home for you too, Bob. Today, the markets were displeased that Apple was up 54%. Let me say that again. The market analysts were displeased that Apple was up
54%. Damn it, we wanted it to be up 75%.
I know, that's the kind of insanity.
Somebody dig up Steve Jobs and whip him a little bit.
They need to put together something, some kind of Jobs tribute. Get Bruce Springsteen on board or something, or whoever they can manage to get.
Ew. David, have a good evening, brother.
All right, Bob. One last thing.
Sure.
Look for in your mailbox the George Harrison document.
I will. I can't wait to watch it.
All right, later.
See ya. Bye now.
Bye.
Pop culture correspondent David calling from Maine. David never had Godfathers. Texas Betsy says in the chat room she'd never even heard of Godfathers till this campaign season. That's because I remember when there were Godfathers standalone restaurant/stores, and they sucked then. I remember there was one in my hometown in Alabama, and it did. It sucked for air. But then they expanded into sort of preheatable, reheatable, nasty little rings of dough with second quality goop on them, and they sold them in convenience stores and gas stations. And we had one here. And yeah, I had a couple of slices. And every time I ate it, well, I won't tell you what, and it had nothing to do with my bad guts. It had to do with bad pizza. Jesus, the dough? And it makes sense since, Herb Cain intimates that it was owned by Pillsbury. The dough was like that, you know, there's the okay refrigerator case biscuits at the grocery store, and then there's those really nasty little hockey pucks. Well, it was like the dough was made out of those nasty little hockey pucks stretched flat. They were god-awful. And Herb Cain got rich hustling. Okay, little Timmy, little Cindy, little Susie, out of the room. Herb Cain got rich hustling shitty pizza in gas stations. That's like saying you got rich selling condoms out of the machine in the bathroom. It ain't nothing to be proud of. Blech. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Preston.
Well, hey, Preston, how are you?
I'm doing all right. Glad I had the chance to sit down with the Horn family and tune in for a while. Enjoying the conversation, as always.
Oh, it's been wonderful tonight.
Definitely. And last night I was listening to one of your allies, Rick Smith.
And isn't Rick just amazing?
He is. Definitely.
I mean, he is He is a sure enough, no doubt about it, top shelf, first tier talent.
Absolutely. It's such an education to listen to him about, you know, so rarely are labor issues analyzed honestly. And he just does a remarkable job, not just for Pennsylvania issues, but for the nation and the world as a whole. So, so refreshing, definitely. And he interviewed last night the person behind Occupy the Boardroom. I don't know if you know about that effort, but it's to kind of create pen pals between concerned citizens and CEOs and other chief executives of the corporate world. I think a novel idea. You know, I'm sure they'll get a lot of, if they get responses at all, well, what she does with Occupy the Boardroom is provide addresses, names and addresses, and people can write, or I guess you can organize a little gathering outside the homes of some of these people, as they did in New York City recently, going to Rupert Murdoch's house and the homes of some hedge fund.
And as long as they stay nonviolent, I say...
I agree.
Go, man, go!
Yes, stay nonviolent, and even beyond that, be polite, be kind. Be yourselves, because the real issue is how we've been dehumanized. You know, they're so often in their own little worlds, and there's, you know, among the rich, there's a propaganda and, you know, attitude perversion campaign that goes on, and we're just kind of subjects to be avoided and dirty and dumb and won't amount to nothing, or, and we'll do these terrible things if they, you know, take their boots off our necks. Actually, Van Jones made that point last night on the Ed Schultz show. We know what our demands are. You know, take your boots, you know, these financial maneuverings, and take them off our necks. You know, stop driving us into debt slavery, you know, right out as we go to school or go to a hospital or, you know, all the foreclosure issues and on and on. You know, people are saying they don't know what we want. They're faking. They're very familiar with what we want. They just don't want to provide it. So they're being obstinate. So Occupy the Boardroom. We're going to tell our own stories, not being mediated by, you know, the media. What's their TV channel that the super rich have now? Something like the Plum Channel, I think. Their market
demographic. Oh, gosh, yeah. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that thing.
Okay.
Is that the one where they praise things like, I don't know, Lark's Vomit canapes served aboard Maybach automobiles in the...
Right.
Yeah.
Right, and they hop...
It's just one
resort.
It's just one long Robin Leach thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. And they hop from resort to resort, and, yeah, again, there's this distance, you know, between us. And so, yeah, to write them, tell stories, do reach out... and yeah, maybe camp out on their front lawns of their estates and, I don't know, ask them to share some of the extra rooms in their mansions and pay their fair share of tax.
Not doing anything with them, are you there, Herb? Right.
Exactly, exactly. And Herman Cain himself, I mean, was he gonna pretend he did it all himself, an individual entrepreneur?
Well, in light of what Isaac sent along about the fact that he cut his workforce by 50%, you know, there's 50% of people who didn't do it.
Yeah.
Or actually, you know, he rode them until he didn't need them anymore and then kicked them into the street. You know, and that, of course, is the very nature of predatory capitalism. And it's all wrapped up in this Leo Strauss, Milton Friedman, the supremacy of the you know, this almost idolatry of the market. It's disgusting.
I agree. On the other hand, you know, there's predatory capitalism, and then I think there can be at least a humane variety of commerce.
Well, absolutely there can be. And that's I think, Preston, is what the current search is for.
Yeah.
Is you know, what, because capitalism is going, I mean, it's like contemplating the decimal structures that have to come to a finite end, and they're not repeating decimals or the value of pi or anything that just goes on forever. Capitalism, by its very definition, has an end point because it runs out of crap to consume, and it runs out of people to destroy. And we've made the globe, via globalism, we've made the globe small enough that now it becomes apparent that the global capitalists have come pretty close to running out of stuff to ruin.
Yeah, I caught the earlier part of your show when you were talking about the waste we're creating and that we're burying ourselves in, and it brought to mind that film WALL-E.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if you remember the Pixar and the trash compactor robot guy who is dealing with a devastated Earth. It, you know, for being a Pixar kind of cartoon movie, it was very radical, very ominous, or, well, not cheerful in some ways.
Oh, and I remember when right-wing blowhards from the impotent pill-popping, impotent pill-popping propagandist to Hannity to all points in between. I remember when those freaks absolutely had conniptions on air over what they deemed to be the socialist concepts behind WALL-E, and they're trying to get our children's.
I bet. I know. They, you know, they're very astute when it comes to reading political narratives within what's called entertainment.
Oh, well, and here's a recent and classic example of that, Preston. And again, we go back to the impotent pill-popping propagandist. I'm sure you've probably seen in the last few days this news story that comes out that says a lot of what was offered as fact in the blockbuster book Sybil back in the 70s turns out to have not been real.
Okay.
That it was a case of outcomes that were reached because they were badly wanted outcomes, that you had a patient who was extremely suggestible, and a practitioner who very much believed in the theories, and that because of that dynamic, she wound up having these, 57 personalities or whatever, which was actually very rare, and it turns out she didn't have. So, Sybil got busted.
Yeah, stuff like that. It would be helpful to have a serious, not sensational, scandal-mongering sorts of story.
Well, and God knows you're not gonna get that out of Limbaugh, Preston. So,
yeah.
So what does he do? I mean, this is one of those Rick Goodner white courtesy phone, Rick Goodner white courtesy phone moments. I mean, this is transference. This is projection.
Mm-hmm.
He climbs in behind the golden EIB microphone a day or so ago, and took this Sybil story. And from that, he extrapolated that there is a global liberal conspiracy, and this is the poll quote, Preston. And if you feel compelled to run screaming around the room, just put it on speakerphone so we can all hear it. There's a global liberal conspiracy, and he followed up by saying, "So here we have a real-life recent case of an agenda-driven hoax becoming scientific consensus and a popularly accepted concept that real decisions were based on. Sound familiar? Sound familiar, folks? Does it not sound exactly like what's happened with global warming?"
Yeah, they're constantly taking the reality and, flipping it.
I mean, Jesus, it's been years since I watched Sesame Street, but I remember the old bit about, one of these things is not like the others, one of these things does not belong. And
yeah,
I
remember that.
Yeah, comparing Sybil to global warming.
Yeah. But
that's what happens when dangerous opiates rewire your brain.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean,
I think when you mix the opiates with a lot of just hanging around a crowd of corporate propagandists and PR agents for various industries.
I mean, he continued by saying, the United States Congress, the White House, you name it, wherever they have dominated for a significant amount of time, you have perverse corruption, lies, outright fraud, and hoaxes for the all for the express purpose of controlling people, all because they want to control everybody. Now, who do you think is in charge of this stupid Occupy Wall Street thing? The same bunch of fraudsters, the same bunch of liars, the same bunch of hoaxers. Nothing is real.
Strawberry fields forever. And, yeah. You know, the Humpty Dumpty of big business, he's going to be talking the jive. But interestingly, who knows? I'll even hold out hope for Rush. Eric Cantor the other day, he switched his story from, I'm increasingly concerned about the mobs that are gathering, to the other day saying, we understand that there's a disparity of wealth that we need to address.
Oh, sure. And Eric, leave Brittany alone, Cantor, has given a speech now about income inequality in the United States.
More success. Excellent.
And shock of all shocks, you know, Limbaugh came out with this craziness. I talked about it last night. Where he says that Obama is attacking Christians because he sent 100 advisors to try to root out the Lord's Resistance Army?
I noticed that. And pair that with what Herman Cain said recently about it being an allegedly liberal court that sentenced Christ to death.
Yeah. Well, guess,
so they're pushing the buttons of that multi-million, you know, the what left behind right-wing Christian dominionist crowd.
Well, guess what happened? Guess what happened on the floor of the United States Senate, Preston?
After
Limbaugh made that, and he was so proud of it, he put up a transcript. He never does that. He put up a transcript of his remarks about Obama attacking Christians because I guess he thought he was going to get the right wing religion industry demographic back in his fold because you know he's losing listeners. He's hemorrhaging listeners. He's like a sieve now. Nobody cares. So, lo and behold, of all people, you know, not Bernie Sanders, not Barbara Boxer, not anybody that we would recognize as even marginally liberal, but Jim Inhofe, crazy as a sprayed roach right-wing Jim Inhofe, took to the floor of the United States Senate, Preston, and by name called Rush Limbaugh down. Over
oh, wow.
What he said about the Lord's Resistance Army.
Interesting. You know, if you go into the story more deeply, I'm sure, you know, it'd be good to know the context of what's going on in Africa and why we are sending troops in and advisors, and probably Blackwater will be headed there soon if they haven't been there already. So you could criticize the policy decision, but the way Limbaugh does it, it just muddles the issue more and more. That's what they do so often. They just muddle issues, whether it's climate change or
Rex Santorum saying that being made light of in a Saturday Night Live skit was just like a gay teenager committing suicide because they'd been bullied. You know, they conflate these issues. I personally, because I'm a skeptic, Preston, think not because they actually believe this stuff, but rather they believe that their intended audience is so manifestly simple.
They are vulnerable, and we all are, to, you know, there'll be gaps in our own awareness that they'll exploit. They have all these emotional and psychological techniques and lawyer techniques of rhetoric that they use. So it's a constant battle. I mean, and then they get an audience that wants to believe. That's more vulnerable to being deceived, more receptive, because they may be part of the system, and they're making a career out of it. And like Upton Sinclair said something about, it's hard to get a man to understand something when his paycheck depends on him not understanding it.
Exactly.
So people in the coal industry, for example, not wanting to believe realities of climate change or mountaintop removal. So please, Rush or Hannity, tell us lies, you know, sweet lies to help us sleep at night. So breaking through that can be very difficult until you offer different alternatives, you know.
Yeah,
you
and
have
by
a different career in wind power or geothermal. Or
right, whatever. And you know, Brad Friedman in the Green News Report pointed out once again that lo and behold, there are more renewable energy jobs in the United States now than there are coal jobs.
I heard that. That's so good to hear.
But at the same time, the purveyors of disinformation are out there hollering, well, we can't compete with the Chinese in making solar panels.
And you know what else they're hollering now is just simply Solyndra.
Yeah, and that's why I said
hear that all over the place. Anytime you try and bring up the issue of green jobs, they've been trained. They can train their audience to just have these one-word responses.
Their next target, I promise you, because I'm already seeing it in the right-wing pitches that come into my email box, their next target is Tesla Motors.
Okay.
We had that brilliant documentary, Who Killed the Electric Car? Well, they want to kill the electric car again.
They do. There was a sequel, I think, Revenge of the Electric Car, I believe. I need to double check that. But anyway, you know, they're also going after these wonderful bike programs, bike sharing programs.
Oh, that's communism.
It sure is. Developed all, you know, Boston just started one up. Forget the host, not Neil Bortz, but...
Well, Jesus, how long ago was it, Preston, that they were attacking John Hickenlooper? You know, isn't he your mayor?
He is.
For Denver's bike share program.
Okay.
I think Limbaugh may have been the one who did that.
Yeah. Well, one of the right wingers, the story of the day was, I know people who listen to this stuff and have been suckered by it, and it makes me so angry, I can't even tell you. Not at them, but angry at the people manipulating them, being con men. But not Neil Bortz, but someone in that range, you know, of popularity.
Yeah, one of those second-tier guys.
Yeah. But anyway, the narrative was, France had one of those bike share programs, and it's been nothing but problems, vandalism and stolen bikes and this, that, the other thing. And they'll take elements of truth. You know, they have had vandalism. They have had theft problems, very expensive ones. But they leave out these other parts of the story. In France, despite the problems, Paris, they've decided to expand the bicycle sharing program. I think they've got something like, it's either 2,000 or 20,000 bikes, but it's huge. And it's saving, see, the problem is it's saving people money. Saving money and helping the environment digs into the profits of the oil industry, the whole auto industrial complex.
Yeah, they're like curtain peekers, Preston. They're pulling the curtains back every now and then, and they're looking out there, and yeah, they're seeing people walking away from them, and that's why I keep saying that these mocking responses, these desultory responses to Occupy Wall Street are all driven not out of a fundamental difference of policy opinion by the 1%. They are driven by the gut-bending fear of the 1%. The 1% are beginning to get, and past beginning to get, they are actively nervous and they're scared. Not because they think that somebody's going to come after them with pitchforks and torches, but because they're afraid that they're going to be $1 million less wealthy.
Yeah. It's a very narrow life mission of increased profits, whatever cost to what they call externalities of the economy, like the environment and health of your workers and stuff like that.
Well, exactly.
Health of your customers.
Oh, and by the way, David in Tennessee, the Minister of Toaster Awards, has awarded you tonight's celebratory symbolic toaster. For your Strawberry Fields Forever, the quote.
I'm honored to accept that toaster.
You know, if nothing else, we have to start doing toaster certificates or something. I need some artwork designed with a big, really, I don't know, the chromium plated fuel injected toaster, you know, toaster of the night award or something. That would be really cool. Preston, it's been a wonderful conversation. I got to roll. I'm going to try to get one more call in here before, or two more calls in here before we go.
Okay. One last comment.
Sure.
The heads up. Tonight, I on Frontline, if people have Frontline, Maria Hinojosa is doing a program called Lost in Detention. Again, another issue that's been so grotesquely muddled by the right wing is immigration and, you know, a complete absence of discussion of what causes so many people to be economic refugees to begin with. And anyway, I hope they address the trade issues. But anyway, Maria Hinojosa has taken a look at this.
And you're right. It has been profoundly underreported. And one of the things that I was so blessed to be able to do while I was down in coastal Georgia last week was to have some real conversations deeply rooted attempts at understanding and being educated. You know, sometimes the most important thing the white males can do is shut them up and listen.
Yeah.
And we are collectively not real good at that. And so we have to be really, really on top of it. And and when we shut up and listen, we learn amazing things. And I had the opportunity just to hear story after story after story about the immigrant community, documented, undocumented. I heard the beautiful music of American Spanish going back and forth at what seemed like just
high
speed rates, and it just
I got a big part of my political education working as a dishwasher at a Mexican restaurant, working with these guys from Mexico and Guatemala and Honduras. Many parts of the story is very disturbing and a lot of injustice and violence, but also they were amazing people and some of the friendliest people, and it reaffirmed my faith in the human spirit. So anyway, great chatting with you, Bob.
All right, and take care, Preston.
We'll talk soon.
Bye-bye. Bye now. The Horns resident optimist, that's Preston calling from Denver, and I am going to try to get to a couple more phone calls if you're still on the line. A couple of comments along the way. Andy writing from California. Right on, Bob. The liberal institutions have failed by aligning with Democrats. I'm glad you read that piece by Chris Hedges about liberal institutions aligning with Democrats, because I've been upset with Move On aligning too much with Democrats, especially Mr. Obama. I'm also not a fan of Van Jones, his dream team agenda, because he had his insider chance, and instead of fighting the fascist pigs, he laid down and let them roll him. He was completely rolled. Last week at a San Francisco United Educators demonstration against a school privatization conference with Jeb Bush and Rupert Murdoch in town to push their charter school agenda, I ran into an NPR reporter from local KQED. I told him to get his camera and microphone down to the Occupy San Francisco site, which was only a few blocks away, and interview some of the folks there. Do your job. He told me he'd been there. Many of the folks demonstrating for SFUE were from Occupy San Francisco. Later, I thought I should have let him have it, because NPR has had a blackout on the Occupy Wall Street folks. NPR has become just another corporate mouthpiece for the plutocracy or corporatocracy. The next time I see an NPR reporter, I'm going to verbally rail on him or her for its subservience to the plutocracy or corporatocracy. Of course, that's where so much of NPR's money comes from. And continuing onward, Kate writing in from the Front Range. You mentioned Godfather's Pizza and gas station condom machines in the same paragraph. There must be some caustic humor in this metaphor or simile. I didn't hear whether you used like or as in your comparison. Kate's on top of the language. At least the folks who stock those much-needed machines are heroes in my mind. And, yeah, you're right, Kate. I probably was off base. The folks who are out on running pizza keggers don't have to stop at Walgreens. Yep, we still have keggers up here. More seriously, approval has just been given to build another huge wind farm. Good news. Not so good news, it's on sacred Blackfeet ground. Oy! The worst news, the electricity will likely go to the Canadian company who's building it. Bitter with the sweet. Bitter with the sweet. Kate notes, I've never eaten a Godfather's pizza. Kate, you are fortunate. Yeah, I mean, the condom machines serve their purpose. And people who stock them have jobs. I feel a little better about the ones you buy in the drugstore, but, you know, who knows? Yeah, I probably got that one wrong. And Kate noticed, and thank you, Kate. And, we do have a little bit of time left. Are you still there?
Hey there.
Well, hey, what's up?
Well, when you're giving out props, give one out to a gentleman by the name of Peter Yarrow.
Yep, he's been, you're right, I saw your note. He has been, he's been there and hanging with the occupiers.
He's been there from the beginning, just as he and Peter and Mary, he and Paul and Mary were there for the beginning of the Vietnam War demonstrations, the civil rights demonstrations. I mean, they were there from the beginning of it all. And he's just continuing the tradition.
He's gonna walk the walk and talk the talk and live the life for as long as there's life in him. And you have to reverence that, Susan.
And Mary would be down there, but we lost Mary, unfortunately. those three people have done more to change this country than any three people I know of, and that includes politicians, just by getting up in front of a microphone.
And singing. Yep.
Yes. Now, you mentioned something quite a while back about, and I'm going to jump off real fast. You mentioned something quite a while back about Herman Cain talking about end of life here. Herman?
No, that's Herb. Herb. Remember.
Herb.
Yeah, Godzilla from Wasilla renamed him Herb.
Herb. You twit, has it ever occurred to you that if you are elected, there's one state in his union that has an assisted suicide law?
Well, he'd go right after that, because he believes in life, as long as the life is able to eat pizza.
Well, there's a little goodie called states' rights, and you can take your right life and put it where the sun don't shine. You've already been to the Supreme Court twice.
Yep. Thanks, Susan. Have a good night.
Love to everybody.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.
She's absolutely right, but of course nobody in the for-profit media will bring that up for Herb. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. How you doing? This is Bruce calling from Greensboro, North Carolina.
Oh, my God, Bruce. What's happening, brother?
What a way to close the show, huh?
Yeah. You got a minute. Make a minute and 15. Make it work.
All right. In 1 minute, here's the deal, man. Bank of America is helping create new jobs by sending all their business to smaller, locally, region-owned banks. Okay, that's the first point. We're going to argue about this tomorrow. But, that's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about. I tried to call in earlier. Gosh, you've been busy tonight, man.
It has been stacked. It's been stacked.
It has been stacked. It's been wonderful. My son just spent 4 or 5 days here at Occupy Greensboro, and we had a 1,000-person march through downtown, and very peaceful, and it was a wonderful
experience.
Awesome.
Now, Bruce, is this the son who's going to be the running mate with Cassie for the presidency?
Yes.
Here in a couple of decades?
That would be Casey. Yes, he is. He's going to a liberal college, sophomore now, and is God. He's just he's a revolutionary, buddy. I mean, we got a hot one here. So, I'll try to get on tomorrow evening to see if I can get him to come on with us and have a chat with you about what his experience was like down there.
That would be awesome, Bruce.
So, I just wanted to get in on the tail end of the program. You're doing an awesome job, and a lot of really cool stuff tonight, and there's so much I wanted to discuss with you, but I really didn't have a chance. But that's cool.
All right. Well, you know what? That's the cool thing about, five nights a week. We'll get that chance. Take care, brother Bruce.
Absolutely. Okay.
Later. Bye now.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
And that is an early Horn alumnus. That's Bruce Birch. And it's time to get out of here. Thanks, everybody. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and learn there about Coal River Wind.